Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the March 11th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. At the moment, the world is overloaded in crises. In Ukraine, as the U.S.-backed government and Russian-backed separatists are trying to maintain a fragile ceasefire, the American general heading NATO, General Strangelove, appears to be pushing for a confrontation between Europe and Russia that is troubling Washington's European allies. In Syria and Iraq, Iranian military advice and assistance has replaced that of Washington in waging war on Daesh, or as it is called in the West, the Islamic State or ISIS, and that is troubling Israel as much as it is the hawks on its payroll in Washington. In Nigeria, Boko Haram continues to terrorize the people, even as it announces its alliance with the Islamic State, while in Libya, a civil war has divided the country in half, with civilians on all sides paying the price for the French-led intervention by NATO in 2011. There are other crises plaguing and destabilizing countries from the Middle East through Southeast Asia to the African continent. They may differ in scale, but not in their origins, namely the U.S. invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, and NATO's quote-unquote humanitarian intervention in Libya. Not yet in a state of crisis is South Africa, which we haven't looked at in a long time, but that may change as an increasing number of its citizenry become further disenchanted with the levels of government corruption that has plagued the country in the post-apartheid era. That is what I'll be examining in about 20 minutes with Patrick Bond, an internationally recognized economist and political analyst and director of the University of KwaZulu-Natal Center for Civil Society in Durban. Until then, since NPR and Democracy Now! Have been ignoring or downplaying it, let's look at a different type of crisis. It's the one that has emerged between Israel and the United States over the visit to Washington and Congress last week by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and poses the greatest threat to that relationship since President Dwight Eisenhower forced Israeli troops to withdraw from the Sinai after its 1956 invasion of Egypt backed by France and England. He did so just after Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion had declared the conquered land to be Israel's in perpetuity, something Israeli prime ministers have a habit of doing when it's not theirs to take. The pro-Israel lobby back then was nothing like it is now, and there was no one in the Republican Party who was ready to betray their country as there is today. That was long before the Supreme Court turned the government over to the 1% with the Citizens United decision, which in essence turned our system of elections into a rich man's monopoly game. Also, back in 1956, there was no supporter of Israel quite like Sheldon Adelson, one of the world's richest men who was taking full advantage of Citizens United. Adelson has held auditions for prospective Republican presidential candidates at his Venetian Hotel in Las Vegas and has widely acknowledged that he will be the one who anoints his candidate. In the last presidential election, he spent over $150 million, that we know of his casino earnings backing Republican candidates and plans to spend far more than that in 2016 on Israel's behalf. But it's not just Adelson. Last October, the Emergency Committee for Israel, headed by the ubiquitous Fox News talking head and magazine publisher William Kristol, contributed $700,000 to the campaign of Arkansas Senate candidate Tom Cotton. That money paid for a burst of TV ads which helped Cotton win the Senate seat from the incumbent Democrat Mark Pryor. On Monday, Cotton paid Kristol back, putting his name at the head of a letter signed by 46 of his Republican colleagues, warning Iran that once Obama leaves office, any deal concerning Iran's nuclear program signed by Obama in the name of the U.S. government would quickly be revoked by the Republican-controlled Congress. Predictably, President Obama and Vice President Joe Biden denounced the letter, as did a spokesperson for the Iranian government. But nothing has spoken so loud and clear against the treachery of those 47 senators as the petition to the White House that someone with the initial CH from Bogota, New Jersey, launched Monday morning, demanding the prosecution of those senators under the Logan Act, which prohibits politicians from conducting or interfering with negotiations between the U.S. and foreign governments. It was addressed to the White House because President Obama has a policy of responding or having someone in the executive branch respond to any petition that gathers at least 100,000 signatures. The petitioner has 1 month to achieve that goal, which in this case was to be April 8th. When I signed it early yesterday afternoon, there were just under 68,000 signatures. By 7 in the evening, there were more than 115,000, and at 8 p.m. this morning, there were just over 147,000. At the rate it is going, the number of signers is likely to surpass a million, and I'm sure it will be welcomed by President Obama. Let's take it as a sign that Americans are finally waking up to the threat from within. The petition can be found by going to petitions.whitehouse.gov/petitions. That's petitions.whitehouse.gov/petitions, and scroll down till you find this one. What was also startling was the front page of yesterday's edition of the New York Daily News. It is owned by Mortimer Zuckerman, one of America's leading supporters of Israel, whose editorials in the U.S. News & World Report, which he also owned, placed him among the loudest drum beaters for both U.S. wars on Iraq. In bold black letters on Daily News' front page, under photos of Ted Cruz, Mitch McConnell, Ron Paul, and the letter instigator, Tom Cotton, was the word traitors. And the paper reported that, quote, Twitter has turned on the nation's 47 traitors. Outraged Americans on Tuesday blasted the overwhelming majority of Senate Republicans for sending a letter to Iran's leaders, sparking a top trending number 47 traitors hashtag on the social media site following the Daily News front page coverage of the unprecedented missive, end quote. This is the latest episode in the most recent intrusion into the U.S. political arena by Netanyahu, who last Tuesday made his third speech before a joint session of Congress, tying the number of appearances there set by Britain's wartime Prime Minister Winston Churchill. Netanyahu's previous visits had been arranged by AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, to coincide with its annual national conference in Washington. From AIPAC's standpoint, the first two were resounding successes. One would have thought, with the 29 standing ovations he received the last time in 2011, that Netanyahu was the true lord of our realm. How many he received last week is subject to dispute, but not as relevant as the fact that not everyone was standing or applauding, and that 60 Democrats publicly boycotted the event. It was the first time that a tear as a appeared in the fabric of bipartisan support for Israel and its political representatives that AIPAC has carefully nurtured over the years. The break occurred because it was not AIPAC that arranged the Prime Minister's latest speech, but Republican House Speaker John Boehner and Israeli Ambassador American turncoat Ron Dermer, who previously worked for the GOP before transferring his allegiance and citizenship to Israel. It was clearly a political ploy designed to embarrass the president and the Democratic Party, since the stated objective of Netanyahu's speech was to derail the president's negotiations with Iran over its nuclear program, which he tried to do, and it seems to have backfired. Over the past six decades, the organized American Jewish community has developed a power base in Washington, second to none, and has made Congress, for all practical purposes, Israeli-occupied territory. Each year, the national conference of its flagship advocacy group, AIPAC, is the biggest event in Washington, with its attendance ever expanding. This year, it drew a record of 16,000, not including the members of Congress who perform their annual bootlicking ceremonies in exchange for having their names read aloud for prospective funders to hear. It was the nature of Netanyahu's address to the joint session of Congress, however, that was totally without precedent. Who could have imagined that a foreign leader would be invited to take the podium before members of the U.S. House and Senate and to argue against a major policy goal of an American president? Well, it was a little too much for MSNBC's Chris Matthews, so let's hear him.
Do you think that this is Netanyahu right, that the president can't be trusted on getting a secure deal out of Iran?
Well, I'll get to the heart of this speech now. This man from a foreign government walked into the United States legislative chamber and tried to take over U.S. foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you should trust me, not your president, on this. I am the man you should trust. I am your true leader on this question of U.S. Geopolitics. To protect yourself, you must listen to me and not to this president. It was a startling situation to allow someone to come in knowing that that was going to be their message in the chamber of the U.S. Congress. This was a decision made by and certainly complied with by Netanyahu and his ambassador Dermer. They went into the U.S. Congress to take over U.S. foreign policy today from the president. It's a remarkable day when the leaders of the opposition in Congress allowed this to happen. Think it through. What country in the world would let a foreign leader come in and attempt to wrest from the president control of U.S. foreign policy? And that's what the applause was about today. That was what the battle of applauses was about, to take power away from the president. So we'll see. It may succeed. We may see that there's going to be a lot more legislative intent here in terms of any treaty, a stronger push by Congress to insist on a vote up or down on any treaty. But clearly that was what was going on here.
When it comes
to this was a takeover attempt by Netanyahu with his complying American partners to take American foreign policy out of the hands of the president.
And that was Chris Matthews, an angry Chris Matthews. We should have some more anger, but we don't hear it elsewhere. Well, Netanyahu also addresses AIPAC devotees, but it was his speech to Congress where he was treated like royalty that took the headlines and created a controversy that has roiled the American Jewish establishment, as it has many Israeli Jews. An estimated 40,000 of them turned out for a demonstration on Sunday calling for Netanyahu's removal from office. Being placed in a position where they are asked to choose between support for an Israeli prime minister and an American president made a number of liberal Jewish leaders and some not so liberal uncomfortable. Privately and publicly, they had begged Netanyahu to postpone his trip until after Israel's national elections that are scheduled for next Tuesday. If they were worried about an anti-Semitic backlash, he probably would have told them, as he told French Jews after the Charlie Hebdo attack and the killing of four Jews at the Parisian Jewish delicatessen, that they should emigrate to Israel. Well, it was these divisions within the American Jewish community that overwhelmingly votes Democratic that opened the space for a sizable segment of congressional Democrats whose party is heavily dependent on Jewish funders to either boycott Netanyahu's address or publicly criticize him afterward. Among the 60 that skipped the speech were 8 senators, among them Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, and our former Congressman Mike Thompson, whose support for Israel has never been questioned, at least before. Our current representative, Jared Huffman, while electing to hear Netanyahu's speech, had harsh words for him afterward, accusing the Israeli prime minister of trying to push the United States into war. Quote, "This is a prime minister," Huffman said, "who's never seen a war he didn't want our country to fight," end quote, adding that diplomats negotiating with Iran shouldn't be distracted by Netanyahu's address. Given that publicly criticizing an Israeli prime minister has historically been off limits for Congress, this is pretty heady stuff. When Senator Dianne Feinstein does it, as the song goes, this could be the start of something big, like the eventual liberation of Washington from the Israeli yoke. Feinstein told NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday that, quote, "What Prime Minister Netanyahu did here was something that no ally in the United States would have done. I find it humiliating, embarrassing, and very arrogant because this agreement is not yet finished. To trash it before you have the final period on it, before you know what it is, I think is a huge error in judgment for our number one ally in that area," end quote, Dianne Feinstein. I was even ready to embrace my former representative, Nancy Pelosi, now House Minority Leader, when I read that she had said that she was, quote, near tears in listening to Netanyahu insult America's intelligence. That was until I read the rest of her statements, which happily the press ignored. In it, she declared that, quote, listen to this, quote, "The state of Israel stands as the greatest political achievement of the 20th century, and the United States will always have an unshakable commitment to Israel's security," end quote. How anyone who has lived as long as Pelosi, even setting aside Israel's ethnic cleansing of Palestine, ignoring its decades of occupation and brutal wars on Gaza and Lebanon, and creating a headache for the world that won't go away, can seriously claim that Israel becoming a state was the most positive achievement of the last century is beyond me. More important than the ending of the reign of the Western colonial powers over Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Indian subcontinent, more important than ending apartheid in South Africa and Jim Crow in the United States? Well, Nancy Pelosi evidently thinks so, and she's a Democratic Party leader in the House. One thing missing from the press coverage in the U.S. concerning Netanyahu's warning about Iran being on the threshold of building a nuclear weapon, apart from the fact that he is never asked by our subservient reporters about Israel's own nuclear arsenal, is that he has been repeating the same thing for years, and not once has his accusation been backed up by either Israeli or U.S. intelligence. In Israel, the media reports this, but not here. But then, when he arrives at the Israeli Knesset, he's not genuflected to in the manner he is by Congress. As the New York Times described it, quote, what happened Tuesday, quote, with Republicans and most Democrats as his props, the paper's reporters wrote, he entered the House of Representatives to thunderous applause, waving his hand like a conquering hero and being mobbed by fawning lawmakers as he made his way to the lectern, end quote. Leave it to the Daily Show's Jon Stewart to cut him down to size in words that are not suitable for daytime public radio. But Stewart did give his viewers a taste of one of Netanyahu's earlier warnings, this one from 1996.
If Iran's that close, why didn't you bring your urgent warning about Iran going nuclear sooner? Oh, wait, you did. Apparently time was also running out 19 years ago.
The most dangerous of these regimes is Iran. If this regime or its despotic neighbor, Iraq, or to acquire nuclear weapons, this could presage catastrophic consequences. Only the United States can lead this vital international effort to stop the nuclearization of terrorist states. Time is running out. We have to act.
Benjamin Netanyahu, 1996. The Israeli election, just 6 days away, pits the opposition Zionist Union, led by Yitzhak Herzog and Tzipi Livni, against Netanyahu's Likud in what polls show to be a close race. Getting desperate, Netanyahu said in broadcast yesterday that there was, quote, a huge worldwide effort to ensure he loses. Israeli Army Radio, which aired what it said were comments he made on Monday to activists of his right-wing Likud party, interpreted them as referring to foreign funding for democracy groups campaigning for a change of government in Israel. Political parties in Israel are banned from accepting money directly from overseas donors during an election campaign. But such funding is allowed under Israeli law for nonprofit organizations espousing political viewpoints, and U.S. consultants have advised Israeli candidates for years. It is a very tight race, said Netanyahu. Nothing is guaranteed because there's a huge worldwide effort to topple the Likud government, end quote. One thing that concerns him but doesn't mention is the United Arab Bloc running for the first time that could end up as Israel's third largest party. It does concern Israel's foreign minister, the former Moldavian beer hall bouncer, Avigdor Lieberman, who would like to rid the country of all of its Arab citizens. Speaking on Sunday in Herzliya, Lieberman said that Arab citizens who are not loyal to the state of Israel should have their heads chopped off with an axe. And those are quotes, chopped off with an axe. Perhaps he could find a job with the Islamic State.